and welcome back to the locker room. We've got one of the great cricket identities, one of my heroes, really, in Merv Hughes on the line. I'm going to have a chat to Merv today. How are you going, Merv?
Good morning, Neil. Good morning, gentlemen. How are we?
We're going famously. Now, we have a lot of people just finished our cricket show. We've got a lot of people here who would have followed your careers over the years. I'm just thinking back to the 70s when you were probably just a young pup moving into your teenagers and getting interested in cricket, and what sort of heroes you might have had and how you sort of started playing cricket.
Well, played cricket because my father always played cricket. So he was a school teacher, moved around Victoria, spent time at Euroa, Apollo Bay, Myrtleford, Bylertown, and Dad always said that playing sport was a great way to meet people. So for me, it was footy in the winter and cricket during the summer. Also played a little bit of basketball, a little bit of tennis, encouraged to play sort of as many different sports as I could. And Dad always said that it was a good platform to meet different people around the place. And then, from there, you just go on with the one sport that you love. And I really enjoyed the cricket, and I think I was going okay at it, and that's why I kept going. And to answer your first question, I suppose, yeah. The heroes that I had growing up through the 70s are the big three, I call them, Ian Chappell, Dennis Lilly, and Rod Marsh. So I think most people my age would admire those three players, and you know, you have a look at those three being heroes. I was always destined to grow a mustache, wasn't I?
Yeah, well, you were, absolutely. Now, just one more from me, then I know Greg and Mick want to speak as well, but you sort of said you're reasonably good at cricket, and that was the one you focused on. At what stage did you think you were going to get a chance to be selected for Victoria?
1981 when I got selected for Victoria. As a kid, I can just remember playing the backyard cricket and across the road on the netball court. You know, we used to play all these cricket games and playing under 10s, under 14s, under 16s coming up through. I had a couple of years at Myrtleford, and what really helped my progress, I was playing senior cricket in the country when I was sort of 14. So you learn a hell of a lot, and you're playing against obviously players that are bigger and stronger. They hit the ball further and they bowl a little bit faster than you used to, so you adapt pretty quickly to that. But when I got down to Footscray, when you're a kid, you aspire to play, I'm going to be a test cricketer, I'm going to do this. And when I got down to Footscray, started in the thirds, got into the seconds, got into the seniors, and all I was worried about was holding my own spot. And really focusing on that rather than sort of dreaming to go further. And then through a few injuries and retirement, got the opportunity to play for Victoria, and that came as a bit of a shock for me anyway. But you know, a lot of people said that I was on the verge because of the performances I was putting in. And then from Victoria, I had probably a rough 4 years through injury and things like that. I had an SO scholarship to England that was given out to four players a year by Australia. So yeah, I had incentives along the way. And then when I got to the Victorian side, as I said, you just head down trying to hold your spot in the Victorian side. And you started one season really well. And that was the season that we lost all the players to the Rebel Tour to South Africa. So there was plenty of gaps there and the door opened. So opportunity presents itself and the rest is history, I suppose.
And Merv, it's Greg here. You've always been pretty, how can I say this, big boned, I suppose. Did you ever suffer stress?
Mate, just put it on the line. Put it on the line. Don't sugarcoat it.
Did you ever suffer stress fractures during your career? And why do you think it is that these sort of injuries seem to be plaguing Australian fast bowlers these days, with news last week, of course, about James Pattinson?
Yeah, it's just workload. So I can't remember too many bowlers that I grew up with in the state squad. When I first got in the state squad, as a young bowler, you go from training two nights a week during the summer to three, four nights a week. So your workload increases. When you're playing state cricket, you're on the harder pitches because club cricket, pitches are rolled for about a week, 2 weeks, and at the end of the day, you see a bit of a dint in them, so there's a little bit of give. Mm. At state cricket, they're almost rock hard, and at international cricket, they are rock hard. So it's like playing on a slab of cement. So obviously the jarring goes through your body, and probably these days, and Victoria, South Australia, Tasmanian players, I reckon, are more susceptible to those stress fractures because we train indoors. Yeah. So we train on cement slabs, and what happens is you can put all the cushioning you like on a cement slab. It's still a cement slab. Mm. And it's got to remain pretty hard to take your body weight and that. So the bowlers down south, they do a lot of pre-season, and we've asked to bowl in the nets a hell of a lot, and that can't help. And, you know, from James Pattinson, he's had a lot of these stress-type injuries, and it's just solely from the workload that he has. And, you know, people always jump up and down and say, why is this bloke being rested? Why is, you know, we go to the MCG, we want to see these guys play. Well, ultimately, the players are the biggest assets Cricket Australia have, and they've got to look after them. So they don't want the players injured. And you've got physios and fitness guys there. You've got to listen to them. They can virtually tell you when someone's going to break down, just with work-related. So that's why we rest guys.
Merv, you made your test debut in 1985 against India, and in your seventh test match, we all know about your famous test match against the West Indies. You took the hat-trick, you took the 13 wickets, but the game before you took 5 for 67 in an innings against Sri Lanka. Was that the innings that you sort of looked and go, I can play at this level, or was there still a few doubts before playing the West Indies in that famous game?
There's a lot of doubts. I think anyone that goes up a grade, it doesn't matter how confident you are, there's always the little flash in the back of your head that I'm not quite sure about this. I don't know whether I'm ready. I must admit, I thought I was ready for Test cricket. I'd played, you know, I was pretty naive. I'd played 4 or 5 years of Shield cricket. I was going okay there, got up to Test cricket. I thought that I was ready, and you find out very brutally that you're not. You know, a lot of people often ask, can I ever forget my first Test match against India 1985, and no matter how hard I try, I'll never be able to forget it. 123, fifth ball back and 2 drop catches. And you just figure out that there's a huge gulf there. It was just I didn't probably feel comfortable in the Australian side, I reckon, until maybe 89, 90. So when we come back from the Ashes in 89, and then I had a fairly good year back here in 89, 90, and 90, 91. So, it takes you a long time to feel. And this is where I can't handle criticism of new guys in the Australian team. If they fail straight away, there's not too many guys that jump into Test cricket and grab it by the scruff of the neck. You know, we see guys get 100 on debut. We see bowlers bowl really well. But what happens then, they tend to go backwards a little bit because I think we just expect so much from them. So I had the right idea, I reckon, is that you go in and you have an absolute shocker. No one expects anything from you. So what you do from there is actually good, isn't it? It's a bit of a surprise.
Now, if you played in an era where there was a focus on Test cricket and obviously One Day cricket. Now it's completely changed, obviously, with 2020. Your thoughts on the change and sort of a lot of the focus now is on the 2020 stuff and sort of eliminating the 50 over stuff and basically trying to find a spot in the calendar for Shield cricket, all that sort of stuff. There's a massive change since you played, isn't there?
Oh, huge change. Well, 2020 wasn't around when I played. That's how old I am. So, you know, there was a huge difference between One Day cricket and Test cricket. So they just started to pick One Day sides and Test cricket sides, and splitting the two sides. But if you're good enough, you're going to play all forms of the game. And that was the challenge to, I think when I played, the challenge for any player was to show that you're capable of playing both forms of the games back then and also playing on the subcontinent. And I was sort of pigeonholed as a test bowler, and really I didn't play too many One Day games compared to the guys around me that were playing a hell of a lot, and I only played when they needed to rest someone or someone was injured. I get called into the squad, and basically I'm told we don't want to turn you into a defensive bowler. We want you to be an attacking bowler in Test cricket. So the mindset was completely different, as it is now. With 2020, we see guys that start at 2020, and people just think they're 2020 players. And the perfect example of this are blokes like David Warner and Glenn Maxwell, where people just think they're 2020 players, but you've got to be a good player to score runs quickly and hit the ball a long way. So, Davey Warner for me is an exceptional player because I reckon you have a look at him. He's got the best defence in the Australian side. He's always had a good defence, and now he's figured out when to attack and when to defend. And when he defends, it's pretty hard to get him out. But things have changed, and when there's only two countries in the world that actively promote Test cricket, and that is Australia and England, I fear for the future of Test cricket. But the 50-50, now I reckon the one-day games, we play too many meaningless games. You know, everyone says, Australia are going bad, we didn't do well in India, we're falling off the perch. Well, who are the World Cup title holders? Mm-hmm. So, like in football terms, it's no good winning games in June, July. You've got to be winning games in September.
Yeah.
So, it's an interesting way that we think about teams being successful and not being successful.
And you weren't only known for being big bone, Merv, but also for that moustache as well. And is it true that you insured it for £200,000 at one stage? And if so, what were you hoping or thinking could potentially happen to it? That's what
I mean. That was a bit of crap. I got hold of a dodgy marketing bloke up in Sydney who put that out, and he forgot to tell me about it. And I was getting phone calls the day after he put it out about the, I said, where'd you get this one? Mate, this is absolute rubbish. And then we got a phone call for him, so just play along with it. And I'm thinking, well, surely if you're going to promote something, you would have told the person involved to go along with it before the media started talking to him. But that was a bit of nonsense.
Well, it was worth insuring anyway.
Oh, mate, it used to be black and bristling, now it's just grey and withering.
When you're in the Australian team, the story goes that Alan Border gave you the nickname of Fruit Fly. Now, is that correct?
Is that another furphy?
No, that's correct. I reckon within a day of being in the Australian side, I'm a little bit nervous, and I tend to be a little bit active when I'm nervous. And I got Fruit Fly straight away. And a lot of people, why Fruit Fly? Well, obviously Australia's biggest pest. Alan Border was the king of nicknames. He also gave me Gronk. He used to call me Gronk for a little while because he reckons I look like a caveman. And then getting back to the big bones scenario, he called me Pirate there at one stage there, and I'm trying to figure out Pirate. And I was just said, where do you get Pirate from? And he just looked at my stomach and said, you've got a sunken chest.
Very good. I like all of those.
And Merv, in 2005, of course, you replaced Alan Border as a test selector, but were subsequently dropped from the panel in 2010. There was a lot of talk at the time about the need for selectors to be full-time. Is that the case these days? Are they full-time?
There's call for selectors to be full-time. Now, the problem is, it is a full-time job with a part-time pay.
Yeah.
You're never away from it, and you always follow it. So if it's our winter and there's no test or international cricket, guys are playing in England, guys are playing in the IPL. You follow their progress in that just to see how they're tracking and to make sure they're okay. And quite often, the chairman of selectors, who was Trevor Haynes when I first started, and Andrew Hilsey's, would be ringing players at that time of the year, and we're getting reports back. So the thought of a selector's role at that level being part-time is just nonsense. But it's changed a little bit now. I think they've gone down to only the three selectors plus the captain and the coach. And mate, the captain and the coach, when I played, had a fair say. So they were virtually to those selectors where we'd ask them their opinion, and it wouldn't be too often that we'd go against what the captain wanted, especially. You get their input, and I dare say Darren Lehman and Steve Smith now would have a fair input into selection. But ultimately, that'd be like year three guys sitting around a table talking about the Australian side, the first team for Brisbane. It's no different to that. You just sit down and you're talking, you know, I've seen a Queensland West Australia game or a Tasmania South Australia game where Boone's seen the other teams play, and Andrew Hilditch has seen New South Wales play against whoever it is. So you've got a fair understanding of what's going on. We wrote up reports and sent them to each other, and you know, you're constantly on the phone. So it's a bigger job than most people think it is.
Merv, the Ashes just around the corner. In your mind, are we the favourites going in, or what sort of outcome do you think the series might take?
It's going to be an interesting one, isn't it? It's going to be interesting to see what happens with Ben Stokes, whether he gets suspended or whether he gets fined. If he gets suspended, that's going to be a tough one. You know, you can't condone what he did, but having said that, he is a sportsman. You look at it, if it's a fine, it's going to have to be a very, very hefty fine. And if he's suspended, and my view is that if you suspend a player, you punish the team. So I would think he would get a very hefty fine and he'd be on a fairly tight leash. But Joe Root, Cook, you've got Stokes, you've got Anderson and Broad, five world-class players. Those five players are going to have to play very well throughout the series to win it for England, where I think while we've got world-class players, we've got more respect too. And everyone up and running, obviously James Patterson's out with his stress fractures. We mentioned that before, but certainly if Stark, Cummings and Hazelwood are on their feet, if a Hazelwood-type player gets injured, you've got Peter Siddle there ready to step into that fold. You've got Nathan Lyon, who just goes from strength to strength. We've probably got two spots in our batting lineup to sort out. So that number three spot, if Smith bats at four, and that number six spot, so do we go for a spinning option, do we go for a medium pace option, or do we go for our sixth best batsman? It's going to be interesting to see what happens in these first sort of three rounds of Shield cricket to see if any of the younger players put their hands up. But it's going to be an interesting series. It's going to be close. And I'm backing Australia in a real tight battle to win 4-0 with a washout at Sydney.
Well, Merv, you've just produced a book, and that's one of the reasons we get to chat with you today. So Barbecue, Beer and BS is what the book's called. So you've brought together what your three great loves in life, have you?
Yes, most definitely. There's nothing better than standing around a barbecue, having a few quiet beers and talking to BS. I think we've just misnamed the book. I reckon it should have been BS, Beer and Barbecue.
Get the order.
I got to have a rule. But yeah, just with, as you said, the summer of cricket coming up, obviously there'll be a lot of people interested in cricket, watching the cricket. And when it gets to the end of the day, players into a panic to see what they have for dinner. I'll quite easily just go to the Barbecue, Beer and BS and have a look at some of the great offerings in there and go from there. And listen, everyone knows how to cook a barbecue. There's no doubt about that. But what we're doing with this book is just offering, I suppose, those wannabe chefs a bit of a challenge, broaden your horizons and just dazzle the family with some good feed on the barbecue.
Yeah, because I was going to say, Merv, my brother gave me a copy of Fatty Vaughan's Barbecue Tips book or something like that a few years ago, and I've never let him forget it. What makes your sausages better than his?
Well, it's not the sausage. If you get a bad sausage, okay, it's not the sausage, it's the person who cooks it. So you never get a bad sausage, it's the same as you never get a bad beer, unless people don't put it on ice. So, yeah, no, that's, I suppose it's just the whole thing is that people just go to the rissoles, the sausages, the steaks, maybe a bit of chicken, maybe a bit of fish. But with this, it's just sort of opening the horizons of people, broadening the horizons, I should say, and opening the eyes that you can do so much on a barbecue. And it just takes a little bit of effort. And you know, just have a flick through the book. And hopefully it'll give you some ideas. And as I said, the wannabe chefs that want to challenge themselves on the barbecue, you know, you can wow your family and wow your friends.
I'll just whip through a couple that I was impressed by having a look during the week, Merv. Barbecue wrapped scallops with spicy mayo. That sounds nice. Barbecue teriyaki tuna skewers.
Yes.
So it's not just about the sausages, is it?
It's not just about your sausages, your rissoles, and your steaks.
Correct.
So it's about everything. It's, you know, a lot of people get say a snapper, a whole snapper, and I'll put it in the oven. You can put it on a barbecue, wrap it in tin foil, and I just like to wrap it in tin foil, a little bit of lemon through it, and cook it that way, and it gives you a great opportunity. And as we know, it's coming into the good time. To be outside, so get the family outside, just cook a barbecue, have a couple of mates over, and, you know, a few beers roll in and a bit of BS flies out, and away you go. Everyone's happy.
I'm not exactly small bone myself, Merv, so I'll be definitely getting the book, because I don't mind a good barbie, so I'll definitely be looking at that one.
Yeah, well, mate, that's what I said. The thing is you go through the book, there's a lot of things in this book that I haven't had, but obviously, it's there, and you can just have a look at it. And instead of just having sausages, do sausages a little bit differently. Instead of just having the fish on the barbie, do it a little bit differently. But listen, when it comes to cooking, I'm a pretty basic sort of a bloke. You know, it's just easy to go out and throw stuff on the barbecue. But just a little bit of preparation, a little bit of thought, and what this is just encouraging that thought. So jump out of the box and have a look around and see what's there for you.
And the BS would be a few cricket stories involved in that, I'd be guessing,
mate, the BS can be anything you want it to be. It doesn't have to be about cricket. It can be about politics. It can be about the yes or no vote. It could be about anything, gentlemen.
Who did you give the greatest sledge to, Merv? Jarvid Meandad, Robin Smith, someone else?
Oh, Mark Raypatch used to cop it a bit. But the interesting thing about it, like I get a lot of people that talk about Robin Smith and Mark Raypatch in particular. Just on the ground, it was like two bulls locking horns. But ultimately, the guys that I went at hardest on the ground were the blokes, funnily enough, the blokes that I got on best with off the ground. So Robin Smith, always had a beer with him. Mark Raypatch, you know, catch up now. We just have a laugh about what we did. So what happens on the ground to me stays on the ground. I reckon now, it's not staying on the ground. A lot of people sort of take it personally, and in this day and age, a lot of people get offended by what's said on the ground. Just think, mate, just move on. If you're more worried about what other people are saying rather than what you're doing, you're going to have problems. So ultimately, I got told that when I was a young bloke, as I said, playing senior cricket when I was about 14, people used to get into me verbally, and my dad always used to say to me, son, sticks and stones. Sticks and stones. You know, you can get peppered by a bouncer, that's going to hurt you. What people say can't hurt you unless you let it.
Yeah, fair, good advice. Merv, it's been great having a chat with you. Barbecue, Beer and BS is the book, and we'd encourage a lot of people to get that one coming up to Christmas.
And I tell you what, this book can be summed up in three easy words, my friends.
Yes.
Ideal Christmas present.
Very good, Merv. Cheers, Merv. Thanks for chatting today.
No worries. Thanks, guys. Thanks for your support.
Thanks, Merv.